HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Inexplicably Me, a story of labels, worthiness, and refusing to be boxed in by Chelsea Austin Montgomery Duban Vechter. Read by Chelsea Austin Montgomery Duban Vechter. For Dad, Daddy, and Dommy, because we can never put into words just how much we love each other. We did not know what to make of her. In our minds, we tried to pin her to a cork board like a butterfly, but the pin merely went through and away she flew. Jerry Spinelli, Stargirl. Preface. I sat crying in my car this morning. They were happy tears, and this is definitely not out of the ordinary for me. I was thinking of how, if I could make one wish for all humans on this planet, I would wish that every single day, we all woke up with the courage to define ourselves regardless of who the world tells us to be. I will never deny that the blessings and privilege I have benefited from have given me an advantage, a huge one. I have always felt I was loved and wanted immeasurably, and my parents have always reminded me of that. The world was always my oyster. And in this beautiful bubble, I grew up thinking all kids thought as I did, believing that they could do anything they set their minds to. I thought their parents must have also told them that anything is possible. If every little kid had an angel who would love them as much as my parents loved me, then every one of us would believe there is room for everyone on the planet to have it all. Maybe we would be less competitive and more loving with each other. I may not have known how to express it as a little tyke, but as I got older, I realized the necessity of spreading the gospel of tolerance, which I believe starts with self-acceptance. Even if your parents did not teach you to love yourself like mine did, you can come to know that the world's love is unlimited, not divisible like pieces of pie. I have come to realize over my 27 years on this planet that there is a common factor among people who are achieving their dreams. Those who are able to find their purpose with inner peace refuse to let the world define them. They refuse to believe that they should be labeled by how they were raised or where they were born or their gender identity, race, religion, socioeconomic status, level of ability, or sexual orientation. Those who have chosen to find joy have looked at their surroundings and decided those surroundings are not limitations or definitions, but springboards. Those who believe they can check step one off their list. Just remember this. We define our worth. We approve of ourselves. We choose what we identify as. We are allowed to start over any time. Don't look out, look in. Expect the best. Breathe when things get tough. Love immensely and deeply yourself and others. Have a vast amount of gratitude. Trust yourself. Laugh at yourself. Love. Take some deep breaths. Believe in yourself. Okay, enough of this for now. Let's get to how I came to be who I am. Chapter 1. Before I had any names. The two most important days in your life are the day you are born and the day you find out why. Mark Twain. The story of how I came to be lands me in an incredibly stable household as an only child with two adoring and doting fathers. My dads had been together for 11 years when they decided to have me, so they were already seasoned vets in the long-term relationship department. Like many romantic comedies, they met on a blind date. It is a long and complicated story in which my dad's old roommate, Phoebe, and my dad's brother compete for being the reason Dad and Daddy got together. By the way, I still call my parents Dad and Daddy. Don't you still call your parents Mom and Dad? I thought so. I do often find myself explaining to strangers that, yes, I know it is strange that at 27 I call one of my father's daddy, but there are two dads involved here. I call one dad and the other daddy. Those are their names, and that is the way it will be until the end of time. It does get exhausting sometimes. But before I get ahead of myself, let me set the stage. The beaches of Malibu, California are where my story begins. My hometown. No, I am not kidding. And yes, it is paradise. I am blessed and beyond grateful to have grown up there. I did not really realize the whole paradise aspect of it until I spent 4 years away in Pennsylvania shoveling snow until my hands felt like they were going to fall off. I have to say, Malibu is one of the weirdest places in the world. It is a large tourist trap created by a fascination with fame. People come to see celebrities, and most of the stars they want to see do not even live here anymore. It is a gorgeous place, but most of our beaches do not even have toilets or trash cans, and I am sorry, but you can't tell me that you can sit on a beach all day without going number one or number two at some point. The summer can become insufferable with the heat and the traffic, and all of the people who actually live in Malibu run to Los Angeles International Airport and fly to any location not on the coast of California. And to be honest, who cares where we go? I lived in a bubble for most of my life. I was raised in a place where everyone thought being gay was cool. I was also incredibly special. I was the only kid I knew with two gay dads where the kid was not from another marriage or adopted. I was a true test tube baby. Cue gasps and villagers with their pitchforks. I was conceived on a glorious day at UCLA Hospital way back in 1992. Dad even got to see me in a petri dish of four cells. And I am pretty sure he looks at me now the same way he looked at the petri dish on that day, full of hope, joy, and wonder. I kind of wish I had been there to see his face. Let me take you back to the beginning. Before there was a little Chelsea Austin Montgomery Duban, although I would like to believe that time stood still until I came along. 11 years into Dad and Daddy's relationship, they decided to have a kid and knew they could not just get pregnant by happenstance. No real shocker there, considering they are two dudes. They had to make the conscious decision to raise a child together, which I think is pretty amazing. They did not just wake up one day and think, hey, we should have a kid. There is, of course, a good story attached. They had seen three friends in 1 week on different occasions, and all three of their friends, out of the blue, had told Dad and Daddy they would make great parents. Well, that was a weird coincidence. So my fathers took the long drive from Los Angeles up to their haven in Anacortes, Washington, to think about their next adventure in life. I am not exactly sure what was said on the trip up to the Puget Sound, but here is something interesting about Dad and Daddy. My dad was born to have children. He always wanted to have a child. And when he realized at a very young age that he was gay, he became depressed thinking he could not have kids and the picket fence life he dreamed of. He perhaps could not have imagined as a young little gay guy that society and science would eventually come such a long way that he could, in fact, have a child, even one he was biologically related to. When he grew up, he surrounded himself with other people's children and taught children's theater. He is, all around, just one of those humans with, let's say, amazing paternal instincts. Daddy could not have been more different. If there was a kid within 1 mile of wherever he was, he would pray not to have to deal with them. He did not know how to hold a baby and found no joy in watching children play. They were exhausting, they were messy, and most of all, they did not do what you wanted them to. So I imagine the conversation about having a child was interesting. But somehow, on the very long car ride, Dad must have said something right to get Daddy thinking that he, too, could love being a parent. They knew if they were going to have a kid, they did not want to adopt if there was another option. Adoption is an incredible act of selflessness and generosity, but it was not the way they wanted to have a child. They wanted to try to keep it all in the family. So they needed to figure out whose sperm they were going to use and then find an egg donor and a surrogate. Both of my parents have younger sisters, and it was pretty easy to choose who they were going to ask to donate eggs, given that Dad's born-again Christian sister would probably not be so hot on the idea of donating an egg for her very much gay big brother to have a child with his male partner. They asked Daddy's sister, Auntie, as I called her, and she agreed without a moment's thought. She was 10 years Daddy's junior and revered him in a way I have never seen a person revere another human. She would have done anything for him, and this was just the sort of way she could give back to him in a way that made her glow. It was then pretty obvious that Dad would be the sperm donor, because had they used Daddy's sperm, I would have been my own first cousin. Yeah, figure that one out. Then they needed a surrogate. Auntie was not the right fit because she had no children of her own yet, and they thought giving away her firstborn might be too traumatic. They thought and thought about a possible option, but no one came to mind. They did not particularly feel like hiring someone to do the job, and in 1992, it seemed difficult to find a surrogate who would carry a child for two gay men. Dad and Daddy arrived at the Oasis, aka Anacortes, and decided they would each take an hour in separate rooms to make a list of potential surrogates, either family members or very close friends. After an hour, my dads emerged, Daddy with no one on his list, and Dad with one name, Sandy. Dad's cousin Sandy was one of his favorite people growing up. They adored each other. Sandy is easygoing and, dare I say, a bit emotionless to the outside observer. She already had two kids of her own, and without giving away too much personal information about her, she needed a reason to get out of Oklahoma where she had been living. Dad and Daddy called her, and she said she needed some time to think about this massive decision. She was already 45, so it would not be an easy pregnancy from the get-go. While she thought about it, my parents could not sit still, so they decided to get some Mexican food to take their minds off things, as if guacamole and chips could really get your mind off thinking about having a child of your own. When they got back from dinner, they immediately ran to the phone. The red light indicating a message was blinking. Could it be? Would Sandy have called back already? There was only one message on their answering machine. All they heard in Sandy's thick southern accent was, "Well, I'm not getting any younger." And they knew they were on the road to having a child. When I explain how the story proceeded from there, it often requires repeating several times and illustrating with diagrams. Even though everyone and their mother seems to have gay dads now, I used to be so special. It is still a tough scenario to compute for so many, so don't worry if you need to listen to this explanation more than once. You are definitely not the first to be a bit confused and certainly will not be the last. Once Sandy was on board, Dad and Daddy went into high gear trying to figure out the next steps towards having a family. They had heard from a doctor client of Daddy's that UCLA did artificial insemination, but didn't know if they would be willing to do it for them. In the early 1990s, it was not very common for two men to have a child of their own. UCLA got a lot of funding from very conservative and religious organizations that were not keen on helping the LGBTQ community reproduce. So there was a huge risk that if UCLA agreed to facilitate the in vitro fertilization and subsequent pregnancy for a gay couple, they would lose a large chunk of funding. It was not looking great, but my two sweet dads charged forward nonetheless. They cold called UCLA's fertility clinic and told the lovely nurse who answered the phone their story and desire for a child. She said they would have to get approval from the board that oversees the fertility clinic at UCLA, as they had never done IVF for a gay couple before. And, more importantly, they would have to find a doctor willing to perform the procedure. She gave them a couple of names of doctors who did those types of artificial insemination transfers at UCLA. My dad's called all of them, and only one office called them back. Dr. Carolyn said she would do it, but all four parties, Dad, Daddy, Sandy, and Auntie, would have to undergo psychological exams, and the women would have to have physicals performed to make sure everyone was healthy in mind and body. Thankfully, everyone cleared, and a call back to those in charge at UCLA was placed to say they were ready to go. UCLA said the board in charge had approved the IVF procedure, but under one condition. The parties had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. UCLA was afraid that if the religious right got a hold of the news of this procedure and pregnancy, they would try to shut down their department. However, my dad's wanted a child, not to be public figures at the forefront of the LGBTQ movement, so they signed the NDA more than willingly. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. Sandy was initially listed on my birth certificate as my mother and Dad as my father, which would leave Daddy without any legal rights should something happen to Dad or me, God forbid. Dad and Daddy decided they wanted to try to get both of their names on my birth certificate as the two parents. Everyone, my auntie and Sandy included, had to lawyer up to get the change made. They were told it was the first time in California history that a single-parent adoption had been done for a same-sex couple where one of the child's parents was the sperm donor, his cousin the surrogate, and sister-in-law the egg donor. I believe it was very important to Dad and Daddy to feel like they were both equally my parents, that neither one was more related to me than the other, regardless of the biology that created me. Enough of this biology lesson. Let's get back to how I got here in the first place. Sandy moved from Oklahoma into my parents' house, and Daddy gave her a job as an accountant at the accounting firm he owns. Auntie already lived in LA, so she stayed put, but she, Sandy, Dad, and Daddy saw one another almost daily. Now came the not-so-fun part. Auntie and Sandy had to have hormone shots, mostly administered by my dad, much to his chagrin. Every day it was Auntie, then Sandy, then Auntie, then Sandy. As a gay man, he had never seen so many female backsides on such a consistent basis in his life. Auntie and Sandy's menstrual cycles finally synced up, and they were ready for the retrieval of the egg from Auntie and implantation of the embryo in Sandy's uterus. After two painfully unsuccessful and expensive attempts, my parents finally got Sandy knocked up on the third try. They quickly started preparations for the baby. Since it was such a high-risk pregnancy and because Sandy was diagnosed with gestational diabetes, they got to see me through ultrasounds more often than most parents get to see their babies in utero. I do have more cells now, but to my parents, I am the miracle of those four tiny cells astoundingly turning into a human. A human they named Chelsea Austin Montgomery Duban. My friend, I was created out of what seemed to be an impossibility, and in that, I was given a gift. As I've mentioned, I was born with the belief that anything was possible. After all, if I'm here on this planet with a dad who is my biological dad and a daddy who is my biological uncle, isn't anything truly possible? I want to give this gift to you too, my sweet listener. What would happen if, for just a second, you suspended reality and believed that anything was possible? What would your life look like? What if you were the girl with two dads and a bunch of names? Allow yourself to dream big, because I'll let you in on a secret. You don't need to be the girl with two dads and a whole lot of names, because you, just as you are enough. Anything is possible for you, too. Now you just need to believe it. How would your life look if you gave yourself the chance to believe you are capable of all your heart's desires? Chapter 2. When Daddy First Met His Little Princess. I love you right up to the moon and back. Sam McBratney, guess how much I love you. Dad was prepared for me to be born. He was ready and excited, a father already, just without a child to love yet. He could not wait for the day. Daddy, not surprisingly, considering his dislike of most children, was not so ready for the day I would make my entrance into this world. In fact, I think he may have been legitimately terrified. When Dad called Daddy at his office on July 2, 1993, to say Sandy's water had broken and it was time, Daddy asked if Dad could call him once things were a little further along, to which Dad responded, "Absolutely not. Get your ass over to this hospital." I did not come into this world quickly. I made everyone wait for my big entrance as I kept progressing and then regressing up and down the birth canal. Finally, the moment arrived when my little head made its way into the fresh air. Immediately, Dad removed his shirt to make sure the first thing I experienced was skin-to-skin contact. Daddy watched nervously from the corner of the hospital room, looking like a kid who had not done his homework and was hoping not to be called on. Eventually, the doctor noticed Daddy attempting to camouflage himself into the wallpaper and called him out. "You know, Dennis, you can hold her if you want." Daddy nervously emerged from his hiding place. Quietly, in the most tender voice, he asked, "Actually, can I feed her?" "Of course!" The chorus of voices made up of Dad, Auntie, Sandy, the doctor, and the team of nurses around the room replied. Daddy anxiously took a seat in the rocking chair the hospital provided, and Dad delicately handed me over, their newborn miracle. Daddy took the bottle in his other hand and started very gently to feed me. And as Dad describes it, it was like the part of the Christmas story where the Grinch's heart grows three sizes. A few days went by, and the doctors cleared Dad and Daddy to take me home. While Daddy had gotten more comfortable holding and feeding me, the jarring idea of having to take me home without any specific instructions was terrifying. My daddy has never even used a coffee machine without first reading every single syllable of the instruction manual, let alone taking care of a newborn child. I'm pretty sure he kept searching my onesie for some handy tips and was left sorely disappointed and totally freaked out. Things seemed to get even scarier when they arrived home and I refused to eat. For hours, my dads attempted to feed me and I would not take a bottle, no matter how hard they tried. They called the hospital and the doctor informed them that if in a few more hours I was not eating, I would need to be admitted to the hospital. Immediately, both Dad and Daddy went into a state of panic. They imagined feeding tubes and IV drips all hooked up to my teeny 19-inch body. Unsure of what to do next, they called my Uncle Robert, my daddy's brother. He sped over to their house, took me in his arms, and lo and behold, I ate. Turns out I could feel my dad's anxiety. Even then, I was an empath. When my Uncle Rob took me in his experienced parent arms, I was at ease because he was at ease. And from that moment on, I haven't stopped eating. After the eating mishap, my dad started to find their groove. Dad did the night feedings, Daddy would get up early for work and sit me on his lap while he watched world news, and I was officially a member of the Daddy's Girl Club. They were an incredible parenting team, but nothing paralleled the way my daddy loved his little girl. The moment I was born, everything changed for Daddy, or so he's told me. Once he held me in his arms, he knew his purpose in life would be to make sure, no matter what, that I was safe and warm, and that I would come to know what true joy is. Daddy includes these words in his prayers every night. The last thing he always says is, "And God, please keep my little girl safe and warm, and please make sure that she has self-confidence and is happy too." He taught me to say prayers as a means of comforting myself when I couldn't sleep at night. He told me to first say thank you for everything I am grateful for, and that nothing is too large or too small to express gratitude for. From the tiniest things like a delicious cup of coffee, to massive things like appreciation for being alive. He reminds me every day how much he loves me and shows me constantly what true gratitude looks like. It's because of him that I am connected to my gratitude daily, and for that, I am forever grateful. You can use gratitude as a means for coping or celebrating pretty much anything. Whenever things seem to be falling apart, you can tap into the things you're grateful for. Gratitude is an incredible way to also pull yourself out of a bad mood. Even if you can only find one thing, It helps to widen your lens and look at the bigger picture. It's not about ignoring less pleasurable feelings or trying to skip your way out of experiencing tough times, but it's a way to find light within darkness, even if just for a second. It's like a little relief button. To this day, every morning, well, okay, not every morning, but let's say 7 out of 10, I make a quick list of things I'm grateful for. They don't have to be big. They can be anything. A really tasty orange, or a friend texting you out of the blue. You can even keep a running gratitude list that you can come back to at any time. On the days when it's harder to think of something to be grateful for, you'll already have a list of things you can use. Being grateful also attracts more of the things you enjoy and love to you, or so I've noticed in my 27 years on this planet. The more you focus on the things you're grateful for, the more things for which you are grateful seem to appear. How would your days be different if you had a running list of everything you are grateful for to come back to in beautiful or challenging or beautifully challenging times? Chapter 3, Chelsea Austin, Montgomery, Duban. I am out with lanterns, looking for myself. Emily Dickinson. I am insanely proud of my name. I love everything about it and wear it like a badge of honor for all to see. I am not Chelsea Duban. I am not Chelsea Montgomery. I am Chelsea Montgomery Duban. And if I really feel like making people's heads spin, I am Chelsea Austin Montgomery Duban. Daddy always says the more names you have, the more royal you seem. So baby, there is no way I'm not using all of those damn names bestowed upon me. When I was in second grade, my class did a project about our names. We had to research the origin of our names as well as how our parents chose them for us. Since my name was such a big deal to me, this project seemed perfect. When I got home from school, I went into my bedroom. I had a little nameplate in my room that I loved and looked at all the time. It was not anything special, just a blue piece of paper with some flowers on it that slid into a little plastic frame, like a name tag on someone's desk at a call center. I loved it all the same. It was my name. Chelsea. Origin. Old English. Meaning. A seaport. I loved that meaning. A seaport. A place where boats come to dock when the seas are rough. A place where people come to find refuge and peace. A day at the sea. I loved all of these pictures in my mind that my name conjured. I assumed that my parents must have taken a long time, looked through many books, and done much research to find my name. I imagined them poring over baby names together for hours with cups of coffee. They are always drinking coffee. In hand. I imagined them talking about it with friends and family. How on earth would they ever find a name sufficiently special to label such a special human? As I approached Dad with the question, I was filled with anticipation and excitement to finally hear the story of my name. It was sure to be a fairy tale. I walked into the kitchen where Dad's arms were soapy and wet from doing the dishes. Dad, where did you come up with my name? Well, Daddy and I used to have a friend named Chelsea, and she was beautiful and kind and a wonderful person. So I asked Daddy if he liked the name Chelsea, and he said yes. So we decided that would be your name if you were a girl. Or if you were a boy, it was going to be Nathaniel. But we didn't like the nickname Nate, so we settled on Nicholas because it sounded good. I stared at him in utter disbelief. That was the whole story behind my name? He asked Daddy. Daddy said yes, and that was it? I was named after a friend they didn't even speak to anymore? What the heck, man? This story was not the magical tale I had imagined. I asked about my middle name, desperate to hear a less boring justification for it. Oh, that is a good story, said Dad. Thank goodness, I thought to myself. Daddy and I were at an art fair once, and there was an artist painting nameplates. We stopped to watch his work. It was really beautiful. We saw one nameplate he'd already finished with the name Austin on it. We thought it was perfect. And so you became Chelsea Austin. Daddy and I knew we were going to give you both of our last names. We decided Montgomery should go first because of iambic pentameter. I looked at him quizzically. It's something Shakespeare used. You'll learn about it in school one day. It's all about rhythm, though. Montgomery Duban flows. Duban Montgomery sounds choppy.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?